that it will never share or never know it shares, no matter how well we point and talk. Emotional happiness is like that. It's the feeling common to the feelings we have when we see our new granddaughter smile for the first time, receive word of a promotion, help a wayward tourist find the art museum, taste Belgian chocolate toward the back of our tongue, inhale the scent of our lover's shampoo, hear that song we used to like so much in high school but haven't heard in years, touch our cheek to kitten fur, cure cancer, or get a really good snootful of cocaine. These feelings are different, of course, but they also have something in common. A piece of real estate isn't the same as a share of stock, which isn't the same as an ounce of gold, but all are forms of wealth that occupy different points in a scale of value. Similarly, the cocaine experience isn't the kitten fur experience, which isn't the promotion experience, but all are forms of feeling that occupy different points on a scale of happiness. In each of these instances, an encounter with something in the world generates a roughly similar pattern of neural activity, and thus it makes sense that there's something common to our experiences of each, some conceptual coherence that's led human beings to group this hodgepodge of occurrences together in the same linguistic category for as long as anyone can remember. Indeed, when researchers analyze how all the words in a language are related to the others, they inevitably find that the positivity of the words, that is, the extent to which they refer to the experience of happiness or unhappiness, is the single most important determinant of their relationships. Despite Tolstoy's fine efforts, most speakers consider war to be more closely related to vomit than it is to peace. Happiness, then, is the you-know-what-I-mean feeling. If you're a human being who lives in this century and shares some of my cultural conditioning, then my pointing and comparing will have been effective, and you'll know exactly which feeling I mean. If you're an alien who's still struggling with yellow, then happiness is going to be a real challenge. But take heart. I'd be similarly challenged if you told me that on your planet there's a feeling common to the acts of dividing numbers by three, banging one's head lightly on a doorknob, and releasing rhythmic bursts of nitrogen from any orifice at any time except on Tuesday. I'd have no idea what that feeling is, and I could only learn the name and hope to use it politely in conversation. Because emotional happiness is an experience, it can only be approximately defined by its antecedents and by its relation to other experiences. The poet, Alexander Pope, devoted about a quarter of his Essay on Man to the topic of happiness and concluded with this question: "Who thus define it, say they more or less than this, that happiness is happiness." Emotional happiness may resist our efforts to tame it by description, but when we feel it, we have no doubt about its reality and its importance. Everyone who's ever observed human behavior for more than 30 continuous seconds seems to have noticed that people are strongly, perhaps even primarily, perhaps even single-mindedly, motivated to feel happy. If there's ever been a group of human beings who prefer despair to delight, frustration to satisfaction, and pain to pleasure, they must be very good at hiding because no one's ever seen them. People want to be happy, and all the other things they want are typically meant to be means to that end. Even when people forego happiness in the moment by dieting when they could be eating or working late when they could be sleeping, they're usually doing so in order to increase its future yield. The dictionary tells us that to prefer is to choose or want one thing rather than another because it would be more pleasant, which is to say that the pursuit of happiness is built into the very definition of desire. In this sense, a preference for pain and suffering is not so much a diagnosable psychiatric condition as it is an oxymoron. Psychologists have traditionally made striving towards happiness the centerpiece of their theories of human behavior because they found that if they don't, their theories don't work so well. As Sigmund Freud wrote, "The question of the purpose of human life has been raised countless times. It has never yet received a satisfactory answer and perhaps does not admit of one. We will therefore turn to the less ambitious question of what men show by their behavior to be the purpose and intention of their lives. What do they demand of life and wish to achieve in it? The answer to this can hardly be in doubt. They strive after happiness. They want to become happy and to remain so. This endeavor has two sides, a positive and a negative aim. It aims on the one hand at an absence of pain and displeasure, and on the other at the experiencing of strong feelings of pleasure." Freud was an articulate champion of this idea, but not its originator, and the same observation appears in some form or another in the psychological theories of Plato, Aristotle, Hobbes, Mill, Bentham, and others. The philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal was especially clear on this point. He wrote, "All men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. The cause of some going to war and of others avoiding it is the same desire in both, attended with different views. The will never takes the least step but to this object. This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves. Feeling happy because. If every thinker in every century has recognized that people seek emotional happiness, then how has so much confusion arisen over the meaning of the word? One of the problems is that many people consider the desire for happiness to be a bit like the desire for a bowel movement, something we all have, but not something of which we should be especially proud. The kind of happiness they have in mind is cheap and base, a vacuous state of bovine contentment that can't possibly be the basis of a meaningful human life. As the philosopher John Stuart Mill wrote, "It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And if the fool or the pig are a different opinion, it is because they only know their own side of the question." The philosopher Robert Nozick tried to illustrate the ubiquity of this belief by describing a fictitious virtual reality machine that would allow anyone to have any experience they chose, and that would conveniently cause them to forget that they were hooked up to the machine. He concluded that no one would willingly choose to get hooked up for the rest of his life because the happiness he would experience with such a machine wouldn't be happiness at all. Someone whose emotion is based upon egregiously unjustified and false evaluations we will be reluctant to term happy, however he feels. In short, emotional happiness is fine for pigs, but it's a goal unworthy of creatures as sophisticated and capable as we. Now let's take a moment to think about the difficult position that someone who holds this view is in, and let's guess how they might resolve it. If you considered it perfectly tragic for life to be aimed at nothing more substantive and significant than a feeling, and yet you couldn't help but notice that people spend their days seeking happiness, then what might you be tempted to conclude? Bingo. You might be tempted to conclude that the word happiness doesn't indicate a good feeling, but rather that it indicates a very special good feeling that can only be produced by very special means. For example, by living one's life in a proper, moral, meaningful, deep, rich, Socratic, and non-pig-like way. Now that would be the kind of feeling one wouldn't be ashamed to strive for. In fact, the Greeks had a word for this kind of happiness, eudaimonia, which translates literally as good spirit, but which probably means something more like human flourishing or life well lived. For Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, and even Epicurus, a name usually associated with piggish happiness, the only thing that could induce that kind of happiness was the virtuous performance of one's duties, with the precise meaning of virtuous left for each philosopher to work out for himself. The ancient Athenian legislator, Solon, suggested that one could not say that a person was happy until the person's life had ended, because happiness is the result of living up to one's potential. And how can we make such a judgment until we see how the whole thing turns out? A few centuries later, Christian theologians added a nifty twist to this classical conception. Happiness was not merely the product of a life of virtue, but the reward for a life of virtue, and that reward wasn't necessarily to be expected in this lifetime. For 2,000 years, philosophers have felt compelled to identify happiness with virtue, because that's the sort of happiness they think we ought to want. And maybe they're right. But if living one's life virtuously is a cause of happiness, it's not happiness itself. And it does us no good to obfuscate a discussion by calling both the cause and the consequence by the same name. I can produce pain by pricking your finger with a pin, or by electrically stimulating a particular spot in your brain, and the two pains will be identical feelings produced by different means. It would do us no good to call the first of these real pain and the other fake pain. Pain is pain, no matter what causes it. By muddling causes and consequences, philosophers have been forced to construct tortured defenses of some truly astonishing claims. For example, that a Nazi war criminal who's basking on an Argentinian beach is not really happy, whereas the pious missionary who's being eaten alive by cannibals is. Cicero wrote in the 1st century BC, "Happiness will not tremble, however much it is tortured." That statement may be admired for its moxie, but it probably doesn't capture the sentiments of the missionary who was drafted to play the role of the entree. Happiness is a word that we generally use to indicate an experience and not the actions that give rise to it. Does it make any sense to say, "After a day spent killing his parents, Frank was happy"? Indeed it does. We hope there never was such a person. But the sentence is grammatical, well-formed, and easily understood. Frank's a sick puppy, but if he says he's happy and he looks happy, is there a principled reason to doubt him? Does it make any sense to say, "Sue was happy to be in a coma"? No, of course not. If Sue is unconscious, she can't be happy no matter how many good deeds she did before the calamity struck. Or how about this one? The computer obeyed all 10 commandments and was happy as a clam. Again, sorry, but no. There's some remote possibility that clams can be happy because there is some remote possibility that clams have the capacity to feel. There may be something it is like to be a clam. But we can be fairly certain that there's nothing it is like to be a computer, and hence, the computer cannot be happy no matter how many of its neighbor's wives it failed to covet. Happiness refers to feelings. Virtue refers to actions, and those actions can cause those feelings, but not necessarily and not exclusively. Feeling happy about. The you-know-what-I-mean feeling is what people ordinarily mean by happiness, but it's not the only thing they mean. If philosophers have muddled the moral and emotional meanings of the word happiness, then psychologists have muddled the emotional and judgmental meanings equally well and often. For example, when a person says, "All in all, I'm happy about the way my life has gone," psychologists are generally willing to grant that the person is happy. The problem is that people sometimes use the word happy to express their beliefs about the merits of things, such as when they say, "I'm happy they caught the little bastard who broke my windshield," and they say things like this even when they're not feeling anything vaguely resembling pleasure. How do we know when a person's expressing a point of view rather than making a claim about her subjective experience? When the word happy is followed by the words that or about, speakers are usually trying to tell us that we ought to take the word happy as an indication not of their feelings, but rather of their stances. For instance, when our spouse excitedly reveals that she's just been asked to spend 6 months at the company's new branch in Tahiti, while we stay home and mind the kids, we may say, "I'm not happy, of course, but I'm happy that you're happy." Sentences such as these make high school English teachers apoplectic, but they're actually quite sensible if we can just resist the temptation to take every instance of the word happy as an instance of emotional happiness. Indeed, the first time we utter the word, we're letting our spouse know that we are most certainly not having the you-know-what-I-mean feeling, emotional happiness. And the second time we utter the word, we're indicating that we approve of the fact that our spouse is judgmental happiness. When we say we're happy about or happy that, we're merely noting that something is a potential source of pleasurable feeling or a past source of pleasurable feeling, or that we realize it ought to be a source of pleasurable feeling, but that it sure doesn't feel that way at the moment. We're not actually claiming to be experiencing the feeling or anything like it. It would be more appropriate for us to tell our spouse, "I am not happy, but I understand you are, and I can even imagine that were I going to Tahiti, and were you remaining home with these juvenile delinquents, I'd be experiencing happiness rather than admiring yours." Of course, speaking like this requires that we forsake all possibility of human companionship, so we opt for the common shorthand and say we are happy about things, even when we're feeling thoroughly distraught. That's fine, just as long as we keep in mind that we don't always mean what we say. New Yeller. If we were to agree to reserve the word happiness to refer to that class of subjective emotional experiences that are vaguely described as enjoyable or pleasurable, if we were to promise not to use the same word to indicate the morality of the actions one might take to induce those experiences or to indicate our judgments about the merits of those experiences, we might still wonder whether the happiness one gets from helping a little old lady across the street constitutes a different kind of emotional experience, bigger, better, deeper, than the happiness one gets from eating a slice of banana cream pie. Perhaps the happiness one experiences as a result of good deeds feels different from that other sort. In fact, while we're at it, we might as well wonder whether the happiness one gets from eating banana cream pie feels different from the happiness one gets from eating coconut cream pie, or from eating a slice of this banana cream pie rather than a slice of that one. How can we tell whether subjective emotional experiences are different or the same? The truth is that we can't. No more than we can tell whether the yellow experience we have when we look at a school bus is the same yellow experience that others have when they look at the same school bus. Philosophers have flung themselves headlong at this problem for quite some time with little more than bruises to show for it, because when all is said and done, the only way to measure precisely the similarity of two things is for the person who is doing the measuring to compare them side by side, that is, to experience them side by side. And outside of science fiction, no one can actually have another person's experience. When we were children, our mothers taught us to call that looking at the school bus experience yellow. And being compliant little learners, we did as we were told. We were pleased when it later turned out that everyone else in the kindergarten claimed to experience yellow when they looked at a school bus too. But These shared labels may mask the fact that our actual experiences of yellow are quite different, which is why many people don't discover they're colorblind until late in life when an ophthalmologist notices that they don't make the distinctions that others seem to make. So, while it seems rather unlikely that human beings have radically different experiences when they look at a school bus, when they hear a baby cry, or when they smell a former skunk, it is possible. And if you want to believe it, then you have every right, and no one who values her time should try to reason with you. Remembering differences. I hope you aren't giving up that easily. Perhaps the way to determine whether a pair of happinesses actually feel different is to forget about comparing the experiences of different minds and just ask someone who's experienced them both. I may never know if my experience of yellow is different from your experience of yellow, but surely I can tell that my experience of yellow is different from my experience of blue when I mentally compare the two, right? Unfortunately, this strategy is more complicated than it looks. The nub of the problem is that when we say that we're mentally comparing two of our own subjective experiences, we're not actually having the two experiences at the same time. Rather, we're at best having one of them, having already had the other, and when an interrogator asks us which experience made us happier or whether the two happinesses were the same, we're at best comparing something we're currently experiencing with our memory of something we experienced in the past. This would be unobjectionable were it not for the fact that memories, especially memories of experiences, are notoriously unreliable. For example, in one study, researchers showed volunteers a color swatch of the sort one might pick up in the paint aisle of the local hardware store and allowed them to study it for 5 seconds. Some volunteers then spent 30 seconds describing the color, while other volunteers did not. All volunteers were then shown a lineup of 6 color swatches, one of which was the color that they'd seen 30 seconds earlier, and were asked to pick out the original swatch. The first interesting finding was that only 73% of the volunteers who did not describe the color were able to identify it accurately. In other words, fewer than 3/4 of these folks could tell if this experience of yellow was the same as the experience of yellow they had had just a half minute before. The second interesting finding was that describing the color impaired rather than improved performance on the identification task. Only 33% of the volunteers who did describe the color were able to accurately identify the original color. Apparently, the volunteers' verbal descriptions of their experiences overwrote their memories of the experiences themselves, and they ended up remembering not what they had experienced, but what they had said about what they experienced. And what they had said was not clear and precise enough to help them recognize it when they saw it again 30 seconds later. Most of us have been in this position. We tell a friend that we were disappointed with the house Chardonnay at that trendy downtown bistro or with the way the string quartet handled our beloved Bartok's Fourth. But the fact is that we are unlikely to be recalling how the wine actually tasted or how the quartet actually sounded when we make this pronouncement. Rather, we're likely to be recalling that as we left the concert, we mentioned to our companion that both the wine and the music had a promising start and a poor finish. Experiences of Chardonnays, string quartets, altruistic deeds, and banana cream pie are rich, complex, multidimensional, and impalpable. One of the functions of language is to help us palp them, to help us extract and remember the important features of our experiences so that we can analyze and communicate them later. The New York Times Online Film Archive stores critical synopses of films rather than the films themselves, which would take up far too much space, be far too difficult to search, and be thoroughly useless to anyone who wanted to know what a film was like without actually seeing it. Experiences are like movies with several added dimensions, and were our brains to store the full-length feature films of our lives rather than their tidy descriptions, our heads would need to be several times larger. And when we wanted to know or tell others whether the tour of the sculpture garden was worth the price of the ticket, we'd have to replay the entire episode to find out. Every act of memory would require precisely the amount of time that the event being remembered had originally taken, which would permanently sideline us the first time someone asked if we liked growing up in Chicago. So we reduce our experiences to words such as happy, which barely do them justice, but which are the things we can carry reliably and conveniently with us into the future. The smell of the rose is unresurrectable, but if we know it was good, and we know it was sweet, then we know to stop and smell the next one. Perceiving differences. Our remembrance of things past is imperfect. Thus, comparing our new happiness with our memory of our old happiness is a risky way to determine whether two subjective experiences are really different. So let's try a slightly modified approach. If we can't remember the feeling of yesterday's banana cream pie well enough to compare it with the feeling of today's good deed, perhaps the solution is to compare experiences that are so close together in time that we can actually watch them change. For instance, if we were to do a version of the color swatch experiment in which we reduced the amount of time that passed between the presentation of the original swatch and the presentation of the lineup, surely people would have no problem identifying the original swatch, right? So what if we reduced the time to, say, 25 seconds? Or 15? 10? How about a fraction of 1? And what if, as a bonus, we made the identification task a bit easier by showing volunteers a color swatch for a few seconds, taking it away for just a fraction of a second, and then showing them one test swatch instead of a lineup of 6, and asking them to tell us whether the single test swatch is the same as the original? No intervening verbal description to confuse their memories, no rival test swatches to confuse their eyes, and only a sliver of a slice of a moment between the presentation of the original and test swatches. Gosh, given how simple we've made the task, shouldn't we predict that everyone will pass it with, flying colors? Yes, but only if we enjoy being wrong. In a study conceptually similar to the one we just designed, researchers asked volunteers to look at a computer screen and read some odd-looking text. What made the text so odd was that it alternated between uppercase and lowercase, so that the first letter was in lowercase, the second in uppercase, the third in lowercase, and so on. Now, as you may know, when people seem to be staring directly at something, their eyes are actually flickering slightly away from the thing they are staring at 3 or 4 times per second, which is why eyeballs look jiggly if you study them up close. The researchers used an eye-tracking device that tells a computer when the volunteer's eyes are fixated on the object on the screen and when they've briefly jiggled away. Whenever the volunteer's eyeballs jiggled away from the text for a fraction of a second, the computer played a trick on them. It changed the case of every letter in the text they were reading, so that a word whose first letter was uppercase and whose second letter was lowercase became a word whose first letter was lowercase and whose second letter was uppercase. Amazingly, volunteers didn't notice that the text was alternating between different styles several times each second as they read it. Subsequent research has shown that people fail to notice a wide range of these so-called visual discontinuities, which is why filmmakers can suddenly change the style of a woman's dress or the color of a man's hair from one cut to the next, or cause an item on a table to disappear entirely, all without ever waking the audience. Interestingly, when people are asked to predict whether they would notice such visual discontinuities, they are quite confident that they would. And it isn't just the subtle changes we miss. Even dramatic changes to the appearance of a scene are sometimes overlooked. In an experiment taken straight from the pages of Candid Camera, researchers arranged for a researcher to approach pedestrians on a college campus and ask for directions to a particular building. While the pedestrian and the researcher conferred over the researcher's map, two construction workers, each holding one end of a large door, rudely cut between them, temporarily obstructing the pedestrian's view of the researcher. As the construction workers passed, the original researcher crouched down behind the door and walked off with the construction workers, while a new researcher, who'd been hiding behind the door all along, took his place and picked up the conversation. The original and substitute researchers were of different heights and builds and had noticeably different voices, haircuts, and clothing. You'd have no trouble telling them apart if they were standing side by side. So what did the good Samaritans who'd stopped to help a lost tourist make of this switcheroo? Not much. In fact, most of the pedestrians failed to notice. Failed to notice that the person to whom they were talking had suddenly been transformed into an entirely new individual. Are we to believe, then, that people can't tell when their experience of the world has changed right before their eyes? Of course not. If we take this research to its logical extreme, we end up as extremists generally do, mired in absurdity and handing out pamphlets. If we could never tell when our experience of the world had changed, how could we know that something was moving? How could we tell whether to stop or go at an intersection? And how could we count beyond one? These experiments tell us that experiences of our former selves are sometimes as opaque to us as the experiences of other people. But more important, they tell us when this is most and least likely to be the case. What was the critical ingredient that allowed each of the foregoing studies to produce the results it did? In each instance, volunteers were not attending to their own experience of a particular aspect of a stimulus at the moment of its transition. In the color swatch study, the swatches were swapped in another room during the 30-second break. In the reading study, the text was changed when the volunteer's eye had momentarily jiggled away. In the door study, the researchers switched places only when a large piece of wood was obstructing the volunteer's view. We wouldn't expect these studies to show the same results if burnt umber became fluorescent mauve, if a word printed in gigantic letters became a word printed in tiny letters, or if an accountant from Poughkeepsie became Queen Elizabeth II while the volunteer was looking right at her, or him, or whatever. And indeed, research has shown that when volunteers are paying close attention to a stimulus at the precise moment that it changes, they do notice that change quickly and reliably. The point of these studies is not that we're hopelessly inept at detecting changes in our experience of the world, but rather that unless our minds are keenly focused on a particular aspect of that experience at the very moment it changes, we'll be forced to rely on our memories, forced to compare our current experience to our recollection of our former experience in order to detect the change. Happy talk. Reba and Laurie Chappelle claim to be happy, and that disturbs us. We're rock-solid certain that it just can't be true, and yet it looks as though there's no foolproof method for comparing their happiness with our own. If they say they're happy, then on what basis can we conclude that they're wrong? Well, we might try the more lawyerly tactic of questioning their ability to know, evaluate, or describe their own experience. They may think they're happy, we could say, but that's only because they don't know what happiness really is. In other words, because Laurie and Reba have never had many of the experiences that we singletons have had, spinning cartwheels in a meadow, snorkeling along the Great Barrier Reef, strolling down the avenue without drawing a crowd, we suspect they may have an impoverished background of happy experiences that leads them to evaluate their lives differently than the rest of us would. If, for instance, we were to give the twins a birthday cake, hand them an 8-point scale, which can be thought of as an artificial language with 8 words for different intensities of happiness, and ask them to report on their subjective experience, they might tell us they felt a joyful 8. But isn't it likely that their 8 and our 8 represent fundamentally different levels of joy, and that their use of the 8-word language is distorted by their unenviable situation, which has never allowed them to discover how happy a person can really be? Laurie and Reba may be using the 8-word language differently than we do because for them, birthday cake is as good as it gets. They label their happiest experience with the happiest word in the 8-word language, naturally, but this shouldn't cause us to overlook the fact that the experience they call 8 is an experience that we might call 4.5. In short, they don't mean happy the way we mean happy. By this account, when the twins say they're ecstatic, they're actually feeling what we feel when we say we're pleased. This is what we might call the language-squishing hypothesis, because it suggests that an impoverished experiential background causes language to be squished, as it were, so that the full range of verbal labels is used to describe a very restricted range of experiences. The language-squishing hypothesis suggests that when given a birthday cake, Laurie and Reba feel exactly as you feel, but they talk about it differently. Squishing language. The nice things about this language-squishing hypothesis are, A, it suggests that everyone everywhere has the same subjective experience when they receive a birthday cake, even if they describe that experience differently, which makes the world a rather simple place to live and bake. And, B, it allows us to go on believing that despite what they say about themselves, Laurie and Reba aren't really happy after all, and thus we're perfectly justified in preferring our lives to theirs. The less nice things about this hypothesis are numerous, and if we worry that Laurie and Reba use the 8-word language differently than we do because they've never enjoyed the thrill of a cartwheel, then we'd better worry about a few other matters, too. For instance, we'd better worry that we've never felt the overwhelming sense of peace and security that comes from knowing that a beloved sibling is always by our side, that we'll never lose her friendship no matter what kind of crummy stuff we may say or do on a bad day, that there will always be someone who knows us as well as we know ourselves, shares our hopes, worries our worries, and so on. If they haven't had our experiences, then we haven't had theirs either, and it's entirely possible that we're the ones with the squished language, that when we say we feel overjoyed, we have no idea what we're talking about because we've never experienced the companionate love, the blissful union, the unadulterated agape that Laurie and Reba have. And all of us, you, me, Laurie, Reba, had better worry that there are experiences far better than those we've had so far. The experience of flying without a plane, of seeing our children win Academy Awards and Pulitzer Prizes, of meeting God and learning the secret handshake, and that everyone's use of the 8-word language is defective, and that no one knows what happiness really is. By that reasoning, we should all follow Solon's advice and never say we are happy until we're dead, because otherwise, if the real thing ever does come along, we'll have used up the word and won't have any way to tell the newspapers about it. But these are just the preliminary worries. There are more. If we wanted to do a thought experiment whose results would demonstrate once and for all that Laurie and Reba just don't know what happiness really is, perhaps we should imagine that with a wave of a magic wand we could split them apart and allow them to experience life as singletons. If after a few weeks on their own they came to us, repudiated their former claims, and begged not to be changed back to their former state, shouldn't that convince us, as it has apparently convinced them, that they were previously confusing their fours and eights? We've all known someone who had a religious conversion, went through a divorce, or survived a heart attack, and now claims that her eyes are open for the very first time, that despite what she thought and said in her previous incarnation, she was never really happy until now. Are the people who've undergone such marvelous metamorphoses to be taken at their word? Not necessarily. Consider a study in which volunteers were shown some quiz show questions and asked to estimate the likelihood that they could answer them correctly. Some volunteers were shown only the questions, the question-only group, while others were shown both the questions and the answers, the question-and-answer group. Volunteers in the question-only group thought the questions were quite difficult, while those in the question-and-answer group who saw both the questions, for example, what did Philo T. Farnsworth invent, and the answers, for example, the television set, believed that they could have answered the questions easily had they never seen the answers at all. Apparently, once volunteers knew the answers, the questions seemed simple. Of course it was the television, everyone knows that. And the volunteers were no longer able to judge how difficult the questions would seem to someone who didn't share their knowledge of the answers. Studies such as these demonstrate that once we have an experience, we can't simply set it aside and see the world as we would have seen it had the experience never happened. To the judge's dismay, the jury can't disregard the prosecutor's snide remarks. Our experiences instantly become part of the lens through which we view our entire past, present, and future, and like any lens, they shape and distort what we see. This lens is not like a pair of spectacles that we can set on the nightstand when we find it convenient to do so, but like a pair of contacts that are forever affixed to our eyeballs with superglue. Once we learn to read, we can never again see letters as mere inky squiggles. Once we learn about free jazz, we can never again hear Ornette Coleman's saxophone as a source of noise. Once we learn that Van Gogh was a mental patient or that Ezra Pound was an anti-Semite, we can never again view their art in the same way. If Laurie and Reba were separated for a few weeks, and if they told us that they were happier now than they used to be, they might be right, but they might not. They might just be telling us that the singletons they had become now viewed being conjoined with as much distress as those of us who have always been singletons do. Even if they could remember what they thought, said, and did as conjoined twins, we'd expect their more recent experience as singletons to color their evaluation of the conjoined experience, leaving them unable to say with certainty how conjoined twins who had never been singletons actually feel. In a sense, the experience of separation would make them us, and thus, they'd be in the same difficult position that we're in when we try to imagine the experience of being conjoined. Becoming singletons would affect their views of the past in ways they could not simply set aside. All of this means that when people have new experiences that lead them to claim that their language was squished, that they weren't really happy even though they said so and thought so at the time, they can be mistaken. In other words, people can be wrong in the present when they say they were wrong in the past. Stretching experience. Laurie and Reba haven't done many of the things that for the rest of us give rise to feelings near the top of the happiness scale. Cartwheels, scuba diving, name your poison. And surely, this must make a difference. If impoverished experiential backgrounds don't necessarily squish language, then what do they do instead? Let's assume that Laurie and Reba really do have an impoverished experiential background against which to evaluate something as simple as, say, the dutiful presentation of a chocolate cake on their birthday. One possibility is that their impoverished experiential background would squish their language. But another possibility is that their impoverished experiential background would not squish their language so much as it would stretch their experience. That is, when they say eight, they mean exactly the same thing we mean when we say eight, because when they receive a birthday cake, they feel exactly the same way the rest of us feel when we do underwater cartwheels along the Great Barrier Reef. Let's call this the experience-stretching hypothesis. Experience-stretching is a bizarre phrase, but not a bizarre idea. We often say of others who claim to be happy despite circumstances that we believe should preclude it that they only think they're happy because they don't know what they're missing. Okay, sure, but that's the point. Not knowing what we're missing can mean that we are truly happy under circumstances that would not allow us to be happy once we have experienced the missing thing. It does not mean that those who don't know what they're missing are less happy than those who have it. Examples abound in my life and yours, so let's talk about mine. I occasionally smoke a cigar because it makes me happy, and my wife occasionally fails to understand why I must have a cigar to be happy when she can apparently be just as happy without one, and even happier without me having one. But the experience-stretching hypothesis suggests that I too could have been happy without cigars if only I hadn't experienced their pharmacological mysteries in my wayward youth. But I did, and because I did, I now know what I'm missing when I don't. Hence, that glorious moment during my spring vacation when I'm reclining in a lawn chair on the golden sands of Kauai, sipping Talisker and watching the sun slip slowly into a taffeta sea is just not quite perfect if I don't also have something stinky and Cuban in my mouth. I could press both my luck and my marriage by advancing the language-squishing hypothesis, carefully explaining to my wife that because she's never experienced the pungent earthiness of a Monte Cristo No. 4, she has an impoverished experiential background and therefore does not know what happiness really is. I would lose, of course, because I always do, but in this case, I would deserve it. Doesn't it make better sense to say that by learning to enjoy cigars, I changed my experiential background and inadvertently ruined all future experiences that do not include them? The Hawaiian sunset was an 8, until the Hawaiian sunset a la Stogie took its place and reduced the cigarless sunset to a mere 7. But we've talked enough about me and my vacation, let's talk about me and my guitar. I've played the guitar for years, and I get very little pleasure from executing an endless repetition of 3-chord blues. But when I first learned to play as a teenager, I would sit upstairs in my bedroom happily strumming those 3 chords until my parents banged on the ceiling and invoked their rights under the Geneva Convention. I suppose we could try the language-squishing hypothesis here and say that my eyes have been opened by my improved musical abilities and that I now realize I wasn't really happy in those teenage days. But doesn't it seem more reasonable to invoke the experience-stretching hypothesis and say that an experience that once brought me pleasure no longer does? A man who's given a drink of water after being lost in the Mojave Desert for a week may at that moment rate his happiness as 8. A year later, the same drink might induce him to feel no better than 2. Are we to believe that he was wrong about how happy he was when he took that life-giving sip from a rusty canteen? Or is it more reasonable to say that a sip of water can be a source of ecstasy or a source of moisture, depending on one's experiential background? If impoverished experiential backgrounds squish our language rather than stretch our experience, then children who say they're delighted by peanut butter and jelly are just plain wrong, and they'll admit it later in life when they get their first bite of goose liver, at which time they will be right, until they get older and begin to get heartburn from fatty foods, at which time they will realize that they were wrong then, too. Every day would be a repudiation of the day before, as we experienced greater and greater happiness and realized how thoroughly deluded we were until, conveniently enough, now. So which hypothesis is correct? We can't say. What we can say is that all claims of happiness are claims from someone's point of view, from the perspective of a single human being whose unique collection of past experiences serves as a context, a lens, a background for her evaluation of her current experience. As much as the scientist might wish for it, there isn't a view from nowhere. Once we have an experience, we're thereafter unable to see the world as we did before. Our innocence is lost, and we can't go home again. We may remember what we thought or said, though not necessarily. And we may remember what we did, though not necessarily that either. But the likelihood is depressingly slim that we can resurrect our experience and then evaluate it as we would have back then. In some ways, the cigar-smoking, guitar-playing, pate-eating people we become have no more authority to speak on behalf of the people we used to be than do outside observers. The separated twins may be able to tell us how they now feel about having been conjoined, but they can't tell us how conjoined twins who've never experienced separation feel about it. No one knows if Reba's and Lori's 8 feels like our 8, and that includes all the Reba's and Lori's that will ever be. Onward. On the morning of May 15, 1916, the Arctic explorer Ernest Shackleton began the last leg of one of history's most grueling adventures. His ship, the Endurance, had sunk in the Weddell Sea, stranding him and his crew on Elephant Island. After 7 months, Shackleton and five of his crewmen boarded a small lifeboat, in which they spent 3 weeks crossing 800 miles of frigid, raging ocean. Upon reaching South Georgia Island, the starving, frostbitten men prepared to disembark and cross the island on foot in the hope of reaching a whaling station on the other side. No one had ever survived that trek. Facing almost certain death that morning, Shackleton wrote, "We passed through the narrow mouth of the cove, with the ugly rocks and waving kelp close on either side, turned to the east, and sailed merrily up the bay as the sun broke through the mists and made the tossing waters sparkle around us. We were a curious-looking party on that bright morning, but we were feeling happy. We even broke into song, and but for our Robinson Crusoe appearance, a casual observer might have taken us for a picnic party, sailing on a Norwegian fjord or one of the beautiful sounds of the west coast of New Zealand." Could Shackleton really have meant what he said? Could his happy be our happy, and is there any way to tell? As we've seen, happiness is a subjective experience that's difficult to describe to ourselves and to others. Thus, evaluating people's claims about their own happiness is an exceptionally thorny business. But don't worry, because before business gets better, it gets a whole lot thornier. Chapter 3. Outside Looking In. Go to your bosom, knock there, and ask your heart what it doth know. Shakespeare, Measure for Measure. There aren't many jokes about psychology professors, so we tend to cherish the few we have. Here's one. What do psychology professors say when they pass each other in the hallway? "Hi, you're fine, how am I?" I know, the joke isn't that funny, but the reason it's supposed to be funny is that people shouldn't know how others are feeling, but they should know how they're feeling themselves. "How are you?" is overly familiar for the same reason that "how am I?" is overly strange. And yet, strange as it is, there are times when people seem not to know their own hearts. When conjoined twins claim to be happy, we have to wonder if perhaps they just think they're happy. That is, they may believe what they're saying, but what they're saying may be wrong. Before we can decide whether to accept people's claims about their happiness, we must first decide whether people can, in principle, be mistaken about what they feel. We can be wrong about all sorts of things, the price of soybeans, the lifespan of dust mites, the history of flannel, but can we be wrong about our own emotional experience? Can we believe that we're feeling something we aren't? Are there really folks out there who can't accurately answer the world's most familiar question? Yes, and you'll find one in the mirror. Dazed and Confused. Before we continue, I challenge you to stop and have a nice long look at your thumb. Now, I'll wager that you didn't accept my challenge because looking at your thumb is so easy that it makes for rather pointless sport. Everyone bats 1,000 and the game is called on account of boredom. But if looking at your thumb seems beneath you, just consider what actually has to happen for us to see an object in our environment, a thumb, glazed donut, or a rabid wolverine. In the tiny gap between the time that the light reflected from the surface of the object reaches our eyes and the time that we become aware of the object's identity, our brains must extract and analyze the object's features and compare them with information in our memory to determine what the thing is and what we ought to do about it. This is complicated stuff, so complicated that no scientist yet understands precisely how it happens, and no computer can simulate the trick. But it's just the sort of complicated stuff that brains do with exceptional speed and accuracy. In fact, they perform these analyses with such proficiency that we have the experience of simply looking leftward, seeing a wolverine, feeling afraid, and preparing to do all further analysis from the safety of a sycamore. Think for a moment about how looking ought to happen. If you were designing a brain from scratch, you would probably design it so that it first identified objects in its environment. Sharp teeth, brown fur, weird little snorting sound, hot drool, why, that's a rabid wolverine. And then figured out what to do. Leaving seems like a splendid idea about now. But human brains were not designed from scratch. Rather, their most critical functions were designed first, and their less critical functions were added on like bells and whistles as the millennia passed, which is why the really important parts of your brain, for example, the ones that control your breathing, are down at the bottom, and the parts you could probably live without, for example, the ones that control your temper, sit atop them, like ice cream on a cone. As it turns out, running with great haste from rabid wolverines is much more important than knowing what they are. Indeed, actions such as running away are so vitally important to the survival of terrestrial mammals like the ones from whom we're descended that evolution took no chances and designed the brain to answer the "what should I do" question before the "what is it" question. Experiments have demonstrated that the moment we encounter an object, our brains instantly analyze just a few of its key features and then use the presence or absence of these features to make one very fast and very simple decision. Is this object an important thing to which I ought to respond right now? Rabid wolverines, crying babies, hurled rocks, beckoning mates, cowering prey, these things count for a lot in the game of survival, which requires that we take immediate action when we happen upon them and do not dally to contemplate the finer points of their identities. As such, our brains are designed to decide first whether objects count and to decide later what those objects are. This means that when you turn your head to the left, there's a fraction of a second during which your brain does not know that it is seeing a wolverine, but does know that it is seeing something scary. But how can that be? How can we know something scary if we don't know what it is? To understand how this can happen, just consider how you'd go about identifying a person who's walking toward you across a vast expanse of desert. The first thing to catch your eye would be a small flicker of motion on the horizon. As you stared, you'd soon notice that the motion was that of an object moving toward you. As it came closer, you'd see that the motion was biological. Then you'd see that the biological object was a biped, then a human, then a female, then a fat human female with dark hair and a Budweiser t-shirt, and then, hey, what's Aunt Mabel doing in the Sahara? Your identification of Aunt Mabel would progress. That is, it would begin quite generally and become more specific over time until finally it terminated in a family reunion. Similarly, the identification of a wolverine at your elbow progresses over time, albeit just a few milliseconds, and it too progresses from the general to the specific. Research demonstrates that there's enough information in the very early, very general stages of this identification process to decide whether an object is scary, but not enough information to know what the object is. Once our brains decide that they're in the presence of something scary, they instruct our glands to produce hormones that create a state of heightened physiological arousal. Blood pressure rises, heart rate increases, pupils contract, muscles tense, which prepares us to spring into action. Before our brains have finished the full-scale analysis that will allow us to know that the object is a wolverine, they've already put our bodies into their ready-to-run-away modes, all pumped up and raring to go. The fact that we can feel aroused without knowing exactly what it is that's aroused us has important implications for our ability to identify our own emotions. For example, researchers studied the reactions of some young men who were crossing a long, narrow suspension bridge constructed of wooden boards and wire cables that rocked and swayed 230 feet above the Capilano River in North Vancouver. A young woman approached each man and asked if he would mind completing a survey, and after he did so, the woman gave the man her telephone number and offered to explain her survey project in greater detail if he called. Now, here's the catch. The woman approached some of these young men as they were crossing the bridge, and others only after they had crossed it. As it turned out, the men who had met the woman as they were crossing the bridge were much more likely to call her in the coming days. Why? The men who met the woman in the middle of a shaky, swaying suspension bridge were experiencing intense physiological arousal, which they would normally have identified as fear. But because they were being interviewed by an attractive woman, they mistakenly identified their arousal as sexual attraction. Apparently, feelings that one interprets as fear in the presence of a sheer drop may be interpreted as lust in the presence of a sheer blouse, which is simply to say that people can be wrong about what they're feeling. Comfortably numb. The novelist Graham Greene wrote, "Hatred seems to operate the same glands as love." Indeed, research shows that physiological arousal can be interpreted in a variety of ways, and our interpretation of our arousal depends on what we believe caused it. It's possible to mistake fear for lust, apprehension for guilt, shame for anxiety. But just because we don't always know what to call our emotional experience doesn't mean that we don't know what that experience is like, does it? Perhaps we can't say its name, and perhaps we don't know what made it happen, but we always know what it feels like, right? Is it possible to believe that we're feeling something when we're actually feeling nothing at all? The philosopher Daniel Dennett put the question this way. Suppose someone is given the post-hypnotic suggestion that upon awakening he will have a pain in his wrist. If the hypnosis works, is it a case of pain, hypnotically induced, or merely a case of a person who's been induced to believe he has a pain? If one answers that the hypnosis has induced real pain, suppose the post-hypnotic suggestion had been, on awakening you will believe you have a pain in the wrist. If this suggestion works, is the circumstance just like the previous one? Isn't believing you are in pain tantamount to being in pain? At first blush, the idea that we can mistakenly believe we're feeling pain seems preposterous, if only because the distinction between feeling pain and believing one is feeling pain looks so suspiciously like an artifact of language. But give this idea a second blush while considering the following scenario. You're sitting in a sidewalk cafe, sipping a tangy espresso and contentedly browsing the Sunday newspaper. People are strolling by and taking in the fine morning, and the amorous activities of a young couple at a nearby table attest to the eternal wonder of spring. The song of a scarlet tanager punctuates the yeasty scent of new croissants that wafts from the bakery. The article you're reading on campaign finance reform is quite interesting and all is well until suddenly you realize that you're now reading the third paragraph, that somewhere in the middle of the first you started sniffing baked goods and listening to bird chirps, and that you now have absolutely no idea what the story you're reading is about. Did you actually read that second paragraph, or did you merely dream it? You take a quick look back, and sure enough, all the words are familiar. As you read them again, you can even recall hearing them spoken a few moments ago by that narrator in your head who sounds astonishingly like you and whose voice was submerged for a paragraph or two beneath the sweet distractions of the season. Two questions confront us. First, did you experience the paragraph the first time you read it? Second, if so, did you know you were experiencing it? The answers are yes and no, respectively. You experienced the paragraph, and that's why it was so familiar to you when you went back through it. Had there been an eye tracker at your table, it would have revealed that you didn't stop reading at any point. In fact, you were smack dab in the middle of reading smooth movements when suddenly you caught yourself what? Experiencing without being aware that you were experiencing. That's what. Now, let me slow down for a moment and tread carefully around these words, lest you start listening for the high-pitched tones of the indigo bunting. The word experience comes from the Latin experientia, meaning to try, whereas the word aware comes from the Greek horon, meaning to see. Experience implies participation in an event, whereas awareness implies observation of an event. The two words can normally be substituted in ordinary conversation without much damage, but they are differently inflected. One gives us the sense of being engaged, whereas the other gives us the sense of being cognizant of that engagement. One denotes reflection, while the other denotes the thing being reflected. In fact, awareness can be thought of as a kind of experience of our own experience. When two people argue about whether their dogs are conscious, one is usually using that badly bruised term to mean capable of experience, while the other is using it to mean capable of awareness. Dogs aren't rocks, one argues, so of course they're conscious. Dogs aren't people, the other replies, so of course they're not conscious. Both arguers are probably right. Dogs probably do have an experience of yellow and sweet. There is something it is like to be a dog standing before a sweet yellow thing, even if human beings can never know what that something is. But the experiencing dog is probably not simultaneously aware that it is having that experience, thinking as it chews, damned fine ladyfinger. The distinction between experience and awareness is elusive because most of the time they hang together so nicely. We pop a ladyfinger into our mouths, we experience sweetness, we know we're experiencing sweetness, and nothing about any of this seems even remotely challenging. But if the typically tight bond between experience and awareness leads us to suspect that the distinction between them is just an exercise in hand-waving, you need only rewind the tape a bit and imagine yourself back at the cafe at precisely the moment that your eyes were running across the newsprint and your mind was about to mosey off to contemplate the sounds and smells around you. Now hit play and imagine that your mind wanders away, gets lost, and never comes back. That's right. Imagine that as you experience the newspaper article, your awareness becomes permanently unbound from your experience and you never catch yourself drifting away. Never return to the moment with a start to discover that you're reading. The young couple at the nearby table stop pawing each other long enough to lean over and ask you for the latest news on the campaign finance reform bill, and You patiently explain that you could not possibly know that because, as they would surely see, if only they would pay attention to something other than their glands, you are happily listening to the sounds of spring and not reading a newspaper. The young couple's perplexed by this response because, as far as they can see, you do indeed have a newspaper in your hands and your eyeballs are, in fact, running rapidly across the page even as you deny it. After a bit of whispering and one more smooch, they decide to run a test to determine whether you're telling the truth. Sorry to bother you again, but we're desperate to know how many senators voted for the campaign finance reform bill last week and wonder if you would be good enough to hazard a guess. Because you are sniffing croissants, listening to bird calls, and not reading a newspaper, you have no idea how many senators voted for the bill. But it appears that the only way to get these strange people to mind their own business is to tell them something, so you pull a number out of thin air. How about 41, you offer? And to no one's astonishment but your own, the number is exactly right. This scenario may seem too bizarre to be real. After all, how likely is it that 41 senators would actually vote for campaign finance reform? But it's both. Our visual experience and our awareness of that experience are generated by different parts of our brains. And as such, certain kinds of brain damage, specifically lesions to the primary visual cortical receiving area known as V1, can impair one without impairing the other, causing experience and awareness to lose their normally tight grip on each other. For example, people who suffer from the condition known as blind sight have no awareness of seeing and will truthfully tell you that they're completely blind. Brain scans lend credence to their claims by revealing diminished activity in the areas normally associated with awareness of visual experience. On the other hand, the same scans reveal relatively normal activity in the areas associated with vision. So, if we flash a light on a particular spot on the wall and ask the blind-sighted person if she saw the light we just flashed, she tells us, "No, of course not, as you might infer from the presence of the guide dog, I am blind." But if we ask her to make a guess about where the light might have appeared, just take a stab at it, say anything, point randomly if you like, she guesses correctly far more often than we would expect by chance. She is seeing, if by seeing we mean experiencing the light and acquiring knowledge about its location. But she is blind, if by blind we mean that she's not aware of having seen. Her eyes are projecting the movie of reality on the little theater screen in her head, but the audience is in the lobby getting popcorn. This dissociation between awareness and experience can cause the same sort of spookiness with regard to our emotions. Some people seem to be keenly aware of their moods and feelings and may even have a novelist's gift for describing their every shade and flavor. Others of us come equipped with a somewhat more basic emotional vocabulary that, much to the chagrin of our romantic partners, consists primarily of good, not so good, and I already told you. If our expressive deficit is so profound and protracted that it even occurs outside of football season, we may be diagnosed with alexithymia, which literally means absence of words to describe emotional states. When alexithymics are asked what they are feeling, they usually say nothing. And when they're asked how they're feeling, they usually say, I don't know. Alas, theirs is not a malady that can be cured by a pocket thesaurus or a short course in word power, because alexithymics don't lack the traditional affective lexicon so much as they lack introspective awareness of their emotional states. They seem to have feelings, they just don't seem to know about them. For instance, when researchers show volunteers emotionally evocative pictures of amputations and car wrecks, the physiological responses of alexithymics are indistinguishable from those of normal people. But when they're asked to make verbal ratings of the unpleasantness of those pictures, alexithymics are decidedly less capable than normal people of distinguishing them from pictures of rainbows and puppies. Some evidence suggests that alexithymia is caused by a dysfunction of the anterior cingulate cortex, which is a part of the brain known to mediate our awareness of many things, including our inner states. Just as the decoupling of awareness and visual experience can give rise to blind sight, so the decoupling of awareness and emotional experience can give rise to what we might call numb feel. Apparently, it is possible, at least for some of the people some of the time, to be happy, sad, bored, or curious, and not know it. Warm the happyometer. Once upon a time, there was a bearded god who made a small, flat earth and pasted it in the very middle of the sky so that human beings would be at the center of everything. Then physics came along and complicated the picture with big bangs, quarks, brains, and superstrings, and the payoff for all that critical analysis is that now, several hundred years later, most people have no idea where they are. Psychology has also created problems where once there were none by exposing the flaws in our intuitive understandings of ourselves. Maybe the universe has several small dimensions tucked inside the large ones. Maybe time will eventually stand still or flow backward, and maybe folks like us were never meant to fathom a bit of it. But one thing we can always count on is our own experience. The philosopher and mathematician René Descartes concluded that our experience is the only thing about which we may be completely sure, and that everything else we think